Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in public health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project brings you a half hour of analysis, insight, we hope, and commentary on the media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. Here we are, the editor, the publisher, and the professor. Ira Fussfeld is here, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York.
Nice to see you. Like the swallows, I have found my way back to Capistrano.
Or where, to Albany, at least.
Ira, weren't you on the television?
Didn't I was on the television. I'm glad I don't have a day job to quit. But yes, I was an extra on the Fox sitcom New Girl. It's the second time I've done it. It is.
Cool.
I'd like to think that they found me after nationwide search, but. Mm-hmm. Just so happens that the episode I was on was co-written by my son, so that did happen.
Nepotism!
But it was fun.
They had a character specifically drawn for you?
Well, it could have been, because I played an overweight Jewish man waiting online impatiently in a delicatessen.
That's great.
No method acting.
It took a lot of makeup off
Yes,
wow. Did you do lines? Or
no, but I did interact with the star of the show. I had to wave her off dismissively.
Fantastic. Did the director have to coach you three or four times?
He did it, I think on the second take.
Oh, wow. Take Fussfeld.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Very good. And of course, Alan Chartok was the other voice you heard, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. One take, Alan, they say.
That is.
It's live, whatever comes out. It's kind of like Donald Trump. You know, what you say is what you get, right?
All right, Rex. That's it.
We are launched, ladies and gentlemen. So, you know, I have to say, the recent campaign activity has given great fodder for this program, of course, week after week. Most significantly, I think, in Fox News being Fox News. That is, the morning after the New York Times reported digitally, and the morning that it reported in print, that women had reported Donald Trump touching them inappropriately, let's say, groping them, the Fox News coverage was entirely focused on Donald Trump saying, I'm going to sue the New York Times.
Sure.
They went across town in their morning show to a reporter standing at Trump Tower, because, of course, you have to have some kind of a set, I guess. You have to be there. There was nothing going on at Fox Tower, but the reporter was there. All of it talking about Donald Trump saying, I'm going to sue. And the rest of the media coverage was on the issue itself. So it just does show that Fox News is true to its intent, which is to give you a different take on the news, an intentionally biased conservative take.
It also makes it even funnier when Trump assails the Clinton News Network, CNN, for being pro-Hillary, allegedly, whereas his own Fox News has certainly been that and more regarding Trump. So it's just a nonsense.
Well, a couple of things come out of this. The first, Rex, as you say, is that Trump's yelling, I'm going to sue the Times. You know, free speech, free press. We do know Sullivan versus New York Times. Same thing, Sullivan versus New York Times. And, you know, he's a public figure and he's injected himself into this. And my bet is he doesn't sue anybody. Although, sometimes when you got enough money and enough lawyers, why not just sue?
Well, he could perhaps get it before a judge, but a judge would dismiss it. There'd be summary judgment. So the Times, everybody would spend a few thousand dollars on a lawyer. Because as you know, the standards are, you have to have either reckless disregard for the truth or intentional malice. And I don't think he's going to be able to make even a prima facie case that the Times had either going on.
The only way would be if somehow they could prove that these women were not telling the truth and the Times did not properly vet them, which I frankly don't believe. But beyond that, it would mean that Trump would have to get on the stand and he'd have to reveal his relationship. He doesn't want to go down that. And as you point out, threatening lawsuits is his move. He does file a number of lawsuits, which is also also his move. So this is just another in his long history.
But it is an extraordinary story. I mean, it is true. And I can see why a Trump partisan would be upset, because it is an unusual situation. You don't have this very often, where you have two people engaged in an incident and you basically write a story from the point of view of one of them when the other one says, no, it didn't happen.
Although you call Trump up, the Times reporter did, and she got ranked out on the phone.
She sure did. But what the Times did, if you look at the story, they were meticulous about finding people who got contemporaneous explanations at the time of what went on. That is, these women who were the victims of this groping, allegedly, had told people, were upset about it. It isn't just somebody popping up and saying, oh, yeah, he did it to me, too. They really did meticulously pursue it. And I think an editor would be thinking at this point, okay, what would be the motive? Why would these women do this? Why would you want to put yourself into Donald Trump's line of fire if this weren't true? So I think it probably was a very thoughtful, I'm sure it was a very thoughtful decision by the Times editors to actually do this.
And by the way, very specific. I mean, for the New York Times, we're talking about he put his hand up my skirt. He put his hand on my breast. He was like an octopus. He was all over me. And I had a seat in first class sitting next to him. Now I have to go back to the passenger. It was pretty specific stuff. There's something else I wanted to say about this, Rex and Ira, and that is that I believe the New York Times has shown a real animus towards Trump. I think my own sense of it is that they decided that they were going to start to do stuff they never did before, using the F word, spelling it out, doing this other stuff, because they thought this guy was so dangerous that he shouldn't be president of the United States. And I think that that's why the Times has covered it the way that they have. They've been extraordinarily aggressive, and I particularly appreciate it, because I put my hands over my eyes and I wonder, what the heck would we have if this guy was elected president?
It is different. Animus, I don't know that I see the word animus. I don't know that I agree with that, but certainly the reporting has been different than we've ever seen
okay.
before.
Okay, I would accept any change you want to make to the word animus.
Well, aggressive is accurate. I mean, and I think that the aggression is, psychologists can determine whether the motivation of the Times editors and reporters is to get back at this guy for the kind of inflammatory rhetoric he has used against the media for months and months and months. But that said, the aggression in digging up material on Trump is in large part because he got a free pass for so long, and he's being vetted in real time, and all of these things are coming out of the woodwork now, and I think that they're doing their job. And going back to these allegations from the women and whether or not they're true, and his immediate response is to say they're not true, and for Fox News to defend him by not covering it as aggressively, I have two names for you. One is Cosby and the other is Roger Ailes. I mean, all of a sudden, women start coming out of the woodwork, and the immediate response is to say, well, this can't be true. They're publicity seekers. And then more keep coming out, and more keep coming out. Since the publication, as we speak last night, by the Times, the Palm Beach Post had a story about a woman. People magazine had a story about a woman, and they're going to just keep coming because this is the guy's history. None of this should be a surprise to any of us.
Let's remember that, as my brother used to say to my mother about me, he started it. The fact is, he did start it. He started talking about, on this tape, about what he did to women. And surprise, surprise, the Times and others have been able to, and the news programs have been able to find people who say he did exactly
That's
what he
right.
said he was going to do.
It became a valid course of reporting.
He started it.
And specifically at the last debate, when Anderson Cooper pressed him after the Access Hollywood tape about asking, has he ever done what he described? And he said, no, I've never done what I described.
It's almost like Gary Hart saying
yes.
to reporters, you know, you can follow me. I challenge you. And, of course, they did. And he's not president. He did never become president.
But people with short memories, particularly on the right, who are seeing what the New York Times in particular is doing in its reporting about Trump, forget which newspaper broke the email story about Hillary. I mean, the other side has not been something that the Times has shied away from covering.
That's absolutely true. In fact, competing with the Trump story is, of course, more release from WikiLeaks of internal emails involving the Clinton campaign, which, as anybody who's been close to politics knows, basically is exposing politicians and their aides acting as politicians, trying to figure out what to say, how to say it, what to do. It basically is the internal thinking and back and forth of a campaign. Nothing, I don't think, terribly damaging, though the Trump campaign is trying to portray it.
Well, that's right. Look, I want to go back to what Ira said about, you know, on the one hand, it's Trump. On the other hand, it's Hillary. You know, I think that we tend on that kind of thing to engage in what we could call false equivalency. In other words, Hillary hearing from Debbie Wasserman Schultz or how they should play Bernie or how they should do this or any of these lifted emails doesn't begin to come close to the kinds of things that they're saying about Trump. And I think they know it.
This actually is one of the critiques that I get from readers, people who are upset that when we have, I did put on the front page, for example, when the New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman basically shut down the Trump Foundation, said you're not licensed to do any fundraising in New York State. I thought that was front page worthy, our local, quote unquote, our New York State Attorney General taking action against the presidential candidate. And a reader wrote to me and said, oh, yeah, why didn't you go on the front page with the Clinton Foundation of stuff? Well, first, it wasn't, there was no local. But second, the Clinton Foundation stuff, there is no allegation at all of criminality there. There is no question of illegality. What you saw was people seemingly gaining access to be able to talk to someone to get almost a photo op with the Secretary of State if they were big donors. And this is actually, of course, the way politics works. People get access to Donald Trump by giving him money, too. So it's, as you say, Alan, it's false equivalency. And that is, we weigh this stuff all the time. And it looks to partisans as though we're being biased about it, but we're really trying to do it fairly.
Well, let me ask you a question, both of you, regarding illegality. I think we've established on this program over time that if we, the press, get in receipt of information that is surreptitious, if the information has not been stolen and has not gotten to us illegally, we feel no reason not to publish it if it's newsworthy.
Even if it is stolen but not by our decision.
Right.
So, we didn't steal it, and we didn't encourage it.
So where does WikiLeaks fit into that? Now, WikiLeaks, we don't know where they got the information other than it was somehow hacked, whether it was by WikiLeaks or more likely by the Russians. So now we are getting information that was illegally garnered by somebody, and now we're all reporting it.
Yes, but here's what's interesting. Trump's numbers among undecided voters are going down. And I think, going back to something Rex said a few minutes ago, I don't think it's catching fire. In other words, I don't think the WikiLeaks that people are, it's been successfully diffused by the Russian influence in all of this. And the other thing is, it turns out people can make decisions about, you know, is the fact that the DNC is helping Hillary win illegal or terrible? The answer is no.
Yeah, but I would argue that if Trump did not keep stepping on his own message and these new revelations about Trump, had they not come out, the evening cable news
yes.
panels would be all talking incessantly about the Hillary emails.
I think that's true, which is why you saw actually in some of these leaked documents, Hillary's campaign worrying that even the most clownish of candidates, they referred to Ted Cruz, might beat her. And they were just basically hoping that Donald Trump would be the nominee
right.
because they knew that he would step on his own message
right.
this way.
But his own message? Is that what you call it?
Well, step on her message, her message too. He's stepping on it. Whatever he's doing, it's.
And I also think they were afraid that when some people thought Trump might drop out, then Pence would go to the top of the ticket. They don't want that.
Don't do that, right?
Oh no, no. I don't think there's any question. And I think that's where columnists play a very important part, because a lot of us have been writing about this and saying right from the beginning, I've done on the radio in newspaper columns and other places, right from the beginning we've said, oh my God, the last thing, I think, by the way, that's why Trump did better in the second debate than the first debate, because I think she was letting him off the hook so he would survive. Otherwise, she didn't give him a knockout blow.
That's an interesting theory. By the way, on the debate, the role of Martha Raddatz as moderator was pretty interesting, wasn't it? Where she kept stepping in and actually speaking up. I think she kind of makes the case for an aggressive moderator, right?
Well, she does. Of course, the Trump people, by the way, Trump has 40% of the electorate. He had 40% to begin with. He's got 40% today. Nothing has changed. Nothing that comes through on the biased, in quotes, media or anything else has touched those 40%. It's the people in the middle, as I said from the very beginning, who have made the thing, and they read newspapers and they read online, and I think that they are impressed by some of the things they're seeing. But that 40% has not changed.
It's interesting. I wonder what 40% of that, by the way, and if there's a way to ferret this out in polling, I suspect we'll see it. What part of that 40% is people who will vote for the Republican nominee no matter what?
Absolutely.
And what percentage is actually the core Trump?
Well, you know, I heard another interview this morning with a couple of evangelicals who say even if the allegations against Trump are true, they are going to stick with Trump because they believe Hillary is worse, in particular as it relates to the Supreme Court. So you have people who you would think would be, you know, shocked and appalled at what Trump has been allowed alleged to have done, would flee him immediately, and they're not fleeing him. It's as you say, they're sticking. The Republicans are sticking with their person.
And but by the way, and again, the media plays into this because the message that people are getting is being delivered by media one way or the other. Now the fact is that the Republican Congress people, who are being very threatened, they're now thinking that the House of Representatives might go Democratic. First time we've really heard that in any kind of serious way. Those guys, those Republican candidates and incumbents, are between a rock and a hard place. And as we sit here this morning, we are hearing that many of them who denounced Trump and said they wouldn't vote for him are now coming back to say they would vote for him and they will support him because they just can't figure out what to do.
Well, because they're getting negative reaction from the
either way, from the base.
Their will is in the wind. Yeah. They have no backbone at all. Yeah.
What do you want them to do? Figure, okay, I'll go quietly?
I want them to actually have some, you know, perspective. I want them to actually care about something.
You and my wife are exactly the same.
You know?
And can I join the chorus? I presume there is already a chorus that is saying these presidential debates should not have studio audiences. The cheering or the booing is entirely distracting, and it should not be. The Nixon-Kennedy debate, if it taught us a number of lessons, but I think one of them was...
Shave.
and just have it in the studio.
So
that outside influences are not involved.
I think that's true. And I think the town hall style debate shows us the failure of that format.
Well, I agree with you. Yeah, I think it stinks.
I agree. And I think it's also a measure of some members of the media, again, who took this guy with the red sweater and made him a celebrity. It was a cute sidebar.
I was talking about the guy who stood
Ken Bone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he had a red sweater, he became this guy who was on all these talk shows.
And he asked a substantive question.
He did.
And people were amazed.
Yeah, well.
That's why, I suppose it just seems to me that it's just theatrics on the part of the networks. They want to have a town hall style debate.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and if you really want to get at the issues that are important, use genuine, I'm sorry, there's a role for journalists, and that is asking substantive questions on matters of public policy. Not, you know, we moderate a lot of things. The three of us have done this kind of stuff a lot. And one of the things that I really like to do is when you've got a live audience, take questions from the floor in writing, you know, let pass around
That's
three
what
or
I
five
do.
Cards.
Yeah.
And then you can actually interpret and help along so that you're not just throwing out ideas, throwing it open to rather bland questioning.
The downside of that, Mr. Moderator, is that those people who are listening know that you're choosing among the cards that have been sent up. So they'll still blame you for picking the ones that are convenient to your point of view, right?
Yeah.
Like the ancient hippie who, hearing that I was going to use the cards at WAMC when Chuck Schumer announced that he was going to support the Iraq invasion, the ancient hippie came up to me and threw a cup of hot scalding coffee in my face because I wasn't letting him stand up and debate.
Goodness.
Yeah, that's true.
Wow.
It's one of my favorite stories of all time.
Well, I thought the format of the vice presidential debate is the one that they ought to be using without an audience. They're sitting civilized at a desk. The only problem with that format in this particular debate was that the moderator did not interrupt Kane each time he tried to interrupt. I mean, there just should be strict rules in terms of being polite and getting a chance to say what you have to say. Because it just, listen, I know it from being on this program. If I interrupt somebody, not only is it rude, but it's no good for the listeners because there's too many voices speaking at the same time. You don't hear what either of them are saying.
It's true.
You know, one of the things actually that we learn from these recent episodes, actually Margaret Sullivan has pointed this out, the fine media reporter for the Washington Post and former editor of the Buffalo News, is that the Trump tapes show us the value of journalism archives. And archives actually are threatened these days. You know, we have had to cull our archives. We're in the process of, over time, digitizing them so that we'll be able to have a searchable database, and eventually that will happen. But right now, we're in the midst of a situation where if we wanted to find something interesting from the 1970s in Times sure. Union clips, it would be really difficult for us to do so.
Well,
so that's unfortunate. And for TV stations, I would say for WAMC, I'll bet you it's really hard to find stuff that you know is back there in your files somewhere, but how do you find it?
Well, the State University of New York, time for a plug, has decided to archive a lot of material, and they have promised us that they're, and we've sent our stuff up, all the old tapes and the old broadcasts.
That's terrific.
For archival. Well, it's terrific, except they're not doing it.
Yeah.
In other words,
yeah.
I don't have enough manpower to really
sure.
do it right.
So meanwhile, what do you think about the fact that the Trump Access Hollywood tape was discovered by a program that's under the umbrella of NBC and was brought to the attention of NBC News, and they sat on it for several days and didn't run with it until the Washington Post was leaked the tape and ran with it first. So they were scooped on their own story.
Well, can I just say one thing about NBC? NBC has had its troubles with Trump from the very beginning. You'll remember that they disassociated himself, I believe, with the pageant.
Right.
And now they fired Billy, whatever his name is,
yeah. Billy Bush.
And who also was engaged with some of the locker room, you know, talk with Trump. So I think NBC is feet up.
Well, if I were the executive producer in charge of that program, or if I were the president of NBC News even, I would think that would have gotten to the head of NBC News. I'd be really damn embarrassed that I failed to produce that story and I had to wait for the Washington Post to get it out there first.
So the question is, who gave it to the Washington Post?
Right.
I'll be honest with you, Rex.
Mm-hmm.
I've had stories here at WAMC, and I say, and I've called your people
yeah.
or you. Because I think it's better handled in a different format than in mine.
Yeah, well, we have more staff, and so we can do that. You knew that we would get at it, and
yes.
it's the kind of, as you say, it's the kind of format that could get it done. But this is one of those cases where I think they simply, I would guess, I don't really know, I don't think there would have been a decision, no, we're not going to do that story. I suspect they just thought they had more time to do it than they did.
Maybe, but maybe not.
Doesn't look good.
Doesn't look good.
There was no question about the newsworthiness. The only question, legitimate question, would be the legality, and it should not have taken NBC's lawyers long to realize that it was a legitimate tape to play.
Well, it has something to do with PR also. I think that they don't want to lose their, dare I say it, virginity in terms of the way in which they are perceived as covering this race.
Yeah, yeah.
Or legitimacy might be a better word.
To turn to just another topic before our program is over, just so quickly, you know, that has to do with this. An economist at Stanford has done research into investigative reporting, and he argues that costly 6-month and year-long investigative projects often yield 100-fold benefits to society in the reforms they provoke, which I think would argue in favor of taxpayer subsidy of investigative reporting. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, that's fine until the Republicans, for example, or the Trumpists get into office, and then they'll take that money away. I mean, I think, look, I don't even think the Democrats love the idea. You know, the press is always held off at arm's length as a potential enemy. We know that.
Yeah, that is true. It is. I think that actually the value of, in effect, there's a subsidy whenever you have a not-for-profit newsroom. This, WAMC, is a not-for-profit newsroom.
Yes, but we could make it. Without the subsidy.
Yeah, but you don't pay taxes. That's my point.
It wouldn't be easy.
So you get a little bit of money from the government, but you don't pay taxes. And I think there's a good reason for that. I think journalism is a value to society. I think public radio is a value to society. And it's a good thing. You know, I think it's a good economic case can be made for what
we Well, we should have a future program on this very subject,
yeah,
because I think I have some differences with you on
well,
this.
Well, in this political atmosphere, it would never fly. Whether or not it's a good idea or a bad idea, in our opinion, it just won't happen.
People yeah. don't care what we think?
They don't agree with what we think.
But I do want to make it clear that the Democrats and the Republicans have had trouble with us and with you, Rex, and stories that you have done, and I doubt when they're going to be sitting there, they're going to be holding up their hands to help you out.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
I agree.
All right, that's all we got time for this week. The professor, the publisher, and the editor. We thank you, Ira, Alan, and Rex, for joining us on The Media Project.
For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ding-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat.